Welcome to the Console DevTools Podcast, a show all about interesting developer tools. I'm David Mitten, co-founder of Console.
And I'm Jean Young, CEO of Akita Software, an API observability startup. In each episode, we'll discuss two interesting developer tools. We're keeping this to 15 minutes, so let's get started.
First off, this week, we're talking about SourceGraph, which is a code search engine. Now, personally, I've only ever used GitHub's code search, which also very helpfully includes discussions and issues. So whenever I'm looking at a new project, trying something out for myself, I'll often look through the issues to see if there's any problems I should be aware of. But then also, if I'm getting into the code, I want to understand how certain functions are being called or something like that, then I'll pop it into GitHub search and find out what's going on there. But SourceGraph adds quite a bit of extra functionality on top of that. And initially my reaction was, well, can I just get everything from GitHub? But actually when you get into it, the ability to search on some pretty advanced aspects of the code syntax is a really useful feature. So whether that's changing the syntax based on function arguments, searching across multi-line blocks, you can even search inside JSON structures, is a really useful way of trying to understand your source code base. But then it raises an issue with me that I've thought about around microservices versus monolith and also monorepos, because there's quite a big assumption built into the design around where your code is. And is it in a single repository or is it scattered across multiple all over your GitHub organization? Have you thought about this, Jean?
Yeah, I think you raised some really great points. You know, the old-fashioned way to understand code is you get into a new repository and you grep for it. So SourceGraph is definitely grep on steroids, which is very cool. And my first reaction also is like, well, why isn't grep good enough? But I learned my lesson from, you know, when Dropbox came out, I said, why isn't Subversion good enough? And when GitHub came out, I said, why isn't GitHub on the command line good enough? So I've really learned my lesson about user interfaces. But yeah, David, I think you raise a really good point, because if we zoom out, there's this bigger question of, if we're trying to understand our software, what is it that we want to be searching over? Because I don't know if other people were nerds like me and used the internet a lot before the advent of search engines or before they got really good. I remember, you know, websites used to be something you had the address to and you would go to it. It would definitely not be a guarantee that you could get to a website if you didn't have a direct address or an address to a directory that listed the website. And discovering websites was really, really hard before too. You know, I used to be part of some blog rings back in the day. And I remember when Google first came out, it was just incredible because you could actually find websites pretty quickly. You could find them really accurately. And, you know, it took some years. Google wasn't the only one. There was this great search race for companies to do that. And it was really about getting the right abstractions on top of the web. And I think we're entering a similar situation with code, where if we look in the monolith world, I think, you know, there's only so much you can do with searching the code. It all makes a lot of sense. I completely agree with you, David, that in the microservices world is where I think things get really interesting, because there's so many parallels I see to what the web used to look like. You know, the API catalogs that are out there, it's very, very similar to what you saw of the web before search was good. And web search didn't get good by searching better on like the right anchor tags of websites or something like that. What it got better on was PageRank, you know, how, like what websites are actually linking to each other, what websites are actually talking to each other. And improvements in NLP helped make the searching interface better. But the big revelation was that we're not searching on the actual text of the websites themselves necessarily. And so I think in that sense, a question I'll ask is, what is the equivalent of PageRank for code? Is it like fancier syntax searching, because that's the way web search was going, or is it something else?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the big differences that the SourceGraph documentation talks about how they stand out from just plain text search. They've actually built the language servers into the SourceGraph backend, and there's not a single system that is doing the indexing. They're pushing it through language-specific interpreters, so they can really perhaps not fully understand in the sense that humans would, but the computer is trying to understand what the code is actually saying in terms of its structure, not just the syntax elements, and parsing it out using the actual language interpreters and the compilers for each specific language that they support means you can get this level of search that's just not possible if you're just doing simple text matching.
Yeah, I think that's very similar to some of the NLP improvements of what made web search better. But I'll also play devil's advocate again, because I also don't think that's the equivalent of PageRank for code. And so I'll pose a question to the audience. What is the equivalent of the Google PageRank algorithm for code? You know, what websites are actually talking to each other? What should show up at the top of the search results? You know, what is the most relevant code that you're trying to find? Is it the newest? Is it the most used library? Is it something else? I think there's a lot of interesting things to think about once we get, you know, the basics down. And something I think is really cool about SourceGraph is it's basically making the basics just a no-brainer. Like, you have all of the code search you need. And so now we can ask questions like, well, what is the code we're trying to find?
Another question is around the developer flow and where search fits into that. If you're coming to a code base brand new and you've got potentially hundreds of repositories to look through as part of a microservice architecture versus a single repository for a monolith, it's certainly easier to know where to start. But often when I'm searching for code, it's an existing code base I've been working on. I'm in my editor and I'm in the flow of doing something specific, and I'm either looking for a particular function or a particular file. And initially when I was playing with SourceGraph, it launches a web browser, which takes me out of my flow. But they are very specifically arguing in their documentation about how everyone's always got a web browser open. It doesn't need to be built into the IDE. And I'm not sure I entirely agree with that. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, they're right in some sense that that's the way things are right now. Everyone codes with a web browser next to them. That's the way things are. I do agree with you, David, that I think the IDE is just the interaction of the future. And we alluded to this in the Copilot episode, where I don't remember how much I talked about how the IDE was the revelation for me, but there are so many kinds of code analyses that need interactivity to work very well. And I do think that code search is going to be one of them. If you're going to try to understand why someone is looking for a piece of code or a certain kind of functionality, the more context you can get on what they're doing right now, and the more feedback you can get on, is your search on the right path? That's going to be key. And that just comes for free in the IDE. So I think the future of developer experience is going to be very, very IDE based. It's very experimental. No one knows how to do some of this stuff yet. So if I were starting a company, would I start in the IDE? That would be the biggest risk. You can't take that risk and other risks at the same time, basically. Like, that's a very, very big risk right there, but very high reward, because the IDE just is so rich with interactivity.
The big assumption, of course, when you're searching the IDE is that the code is there locally to search through. And this is what SourceGraph is claiming is why it needs to be in the browser, because maybe if you have a mono repo, then all your code is there. But if you're searching across multiple repos, you've got hundreds of microservices, just being able to discover the code that's not checked out locally, it doesn't work, right?
There are ways around that. I think there can be richer IDE interactions, but it's hard. If I were SourceGraph, I wouldn't do it either. It's really risky to build. It's way harder to build. It takes way longer to build. So it makes sense why they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah, pushing people to their browser interface, I suppose, is the first step. But even the VS Code integration that I tried out, it still just launches the browser. Certainly a fun thing I was able to use with that integration is the extension that they have for Chrome. I think they've got a Firefox one as well, where you can just type SRC and it will automatically scope the search in your browser. Instead of searching on Google or DuckDuckGo, whatever search you use, it will search SourceGraph, and just typing SRC to go immediately into a code search. When you've got your browser open all the time, that is pretty convenient.
Yeah, that's super slick.
The second tool today is Hopscotch, and this is a browser user interface for API requests. You can essentially build and execute all types of API requests from HTTP, REST, GraphQL, and WebSocket just in the browser. It gives you a really nice syntax highlighted response, and it can even generate code examples so that you can then paste them into your IDE or into your command line. It does pretty much similar to what you can do on the command line. You can't automate a chain of requests. You have to manually set them up. And there are some limitations that the browser has due to the security model around cause headers and also the cookie headers as well. But I think this is a good example of a successful open source project, over 30,000 stars now, that's following other successful businesses, and Postman comes to mind. What was your take on it?
Yeah, David, I was very surprised when you picked this tool, because I said, look, it sounds exactly like Postman. And then you said, yeah, but you know, people haven't heard of it as much, but it's very popular. So I was really surprised that it has over 30,000 GitHub stars. That's really non-trivial. That's on the higher end of all tools we've talked about. So I think that just goes to show, even if there is an extremely popular, like, I don't remember the latest count of how many Postman users there are, but, you know, it seems like everyone uses Postman or has used Postman. And so if there's even appetite for a second open source tool, that's nuts. You know, that just goes to show how many people need to make API requests these days. So I was hoping to get your insight, David, on how did this tool become so popular? You know, do you have an idea of, like, was there a community strategy they took? Like, you know, did someone pick it up? Did other people just adopt it? Like, what's the background?
So firstly, open source. We discussed this in the previous episode about the philosophy behind open source and why that just gets people engaged, just the ability to modify the code, even if it's just small aspects, just being able to make those tweaks that you need. One of the big things was that you can self-host Hopscotch. And although it is just building HTTP requests and other API requests in the browser, it adds additional functionality about being able to save configuration, whether that's a local storage in the browser. They support GitHub gists as well, but just being able to save the state of your requests and be able to come back to the configuration, being able to self-host that is something I've not seen from Postman.
Yeah, because I am really curious about this because, you know, when we've surveyed our users, would you prefer to self-host or would you prefer for us to host? I think what we're running at Akita, you know, it still has to do with APIs, but it's sufficiently hard to run that people know that. And they say, look, you know, when we were considering putting out our open source offering, they said, look, you can put it out. We'll, like, maybe we'll glance at it, but we would much prefer you host it for us. And so it's surprising to me that self-hosting is a plus for this. Is it just because it's an easier self-hosting, or it sees data that people would prefer not to send over to Postman?
I think the data aspect of it is potentially there, but really, is it that difficult? Because you can just go to the browser and use this. And if you're sending the request to a remote API anyway, what's happening to that data? I was also quite surprised that this does just seem like a really nice UI on top of the command line. And there's a perception that developers prefer the command line, and clearly that's not the case if this is 30,000 stars.
Yeah, I mean, it's similar with Postman because, you know, I think Postman provides a couple of really nice features on top of the command line. So first I was like, wow, this is just like, you know, curl. How is this taking off like wildfire? But I think the ability to store is huge. The ability for Postman at least to share is also huge. That seems like the point where you can't just, you know, share a bunch of curl commands very easily anymore. But yeah, I think that a lot of the motivation for this is the reason we decided to go into API tools as well for Akita, because it's just a set of behaviors that everyone needs to do. Call APIs, understand how you're calling APIs. And to me, so going back to our what is the new page rank, I think just like in the web, there's this graph of websites all talking to each other. In code, there's this graph of APIs all talking to each other now. And I think there's going to be a lot of innovation on how do we understand this? How do we search it? How do we navigate it? And it's cool because curl is like the one of the primitives here.
All right, that's it for this week. Please tell your friends about the podcast and come on Twitter, console.dev, to disagree with us. Do you use a monolith or are you in favor of microservices? And what do you think about code search?
Yeah, and I'll throw out a very controversial question. You know, the web is kind of this messy, messy place, but anyone can find anything and anyone can make anything. And that's where code is headed. And on my Twitter, a lot of people are very upset, especially the people who are like, look, functional languages should have won. It should be very, very clean. And I've just leaned in hard into this, you know, everything is just organically evolving. And so the tools should just be able to help you find what you need to find. And there's just a lot of other craft. And there's fights every day on my Twitter about this, but you know, we'd love to hear from you. Is it a good thing or a bad thing that this is where software is headed? and what are the tools you'd like to see to make it better?
Thanks. See you next week.